So thanks for coming along tonight to our discussion on the current election or the forthcoming election. Now, Aaron Patrick is well known to all of you here, and Gemma Tognetti as well, but Aaron's spoken here before and Gemma makes a welcome first visit. So we start off with Aaron's going to lead off, senior correspondent for the Australian Financial Review and author of a number of books, some of which he's spoken about here, but forthcoming in around June. Ego, the title of the book is Ego, Malcolm Turnbull and the Liberal Party Civil War, which should be interesting. And Gemma Tognetti is Executive Director of GT Communications, but as you know, she's a fortnightly columnist for The Australian. Like Aaron, she appears on Sky News as a commentator, and she also writes a column fortnightly, I think, for The West Australian in Perth. And she's recently moved to Sydney from Perth, as those of us who watch Sky News would be well aware. So let's start with Aaron, then we go to Gemma, then we go to questions and discussion. Patrick. Aaron, sorry. Aaron Patrick. Mr. Patrick.
Thanks, Jared, for that introduction. Before I start, I'd like to acknowledge Jared and Anne Henderson, the greatest pizza connoisseurs there are in North Sydney.
That's a joke.
They actually around the corner from me, and they're devoted fans of our local pizza shop, which does do the worst pizzas I've ever had.
That's defamatory.
And I tried to convince them to shift to a high-end Italian pizza place down the road, but they're overburdened with loyalty to the owner there of Bay Road Pizzas. But look, we're here to talk, I think, about the election. And tonight, I'm going to tell you why the coalition is losing. And it all starts, my little tale of it starts a week ago at a dinner with a group of parents at a private North Sydney school, very conservative, mostly people who live in the seat of North Sydney and Warringah. And we went around the table, we just talked a little bit about the political environment. And what struck me was that in a naturally conservative audience or group who would have grown up around, I guess, liberal values, Liberal Party values, particularly ones which promote and protect wealth and business, there was no enthusiasm for this government, in particular Scott Morrison. And when I put the argument to them, the people who lived in North Sydney, that if they voted independent, they would be taking out a very, I don't like to call them moderate, because I think if you call someone moderate, you're assuming the other side are regressive, and I don't think that's fair, but let's say a centrist, or some people say left-wing, member of the Liberal Party party room, you are likely to contribute to pushing the Liberal Party to the right, the populist right. They didn't care. There was so much resentment towards Scott Morrison that was not an argument that was particularly persuasive. On Saturday night, I was down in Melbourne for a friend's birthday party at a group of people who are mostly liberal backgrounds from the seats of Kooyong and Higgins. Now, Kooyong is the treasurer's seat and Higgins is Katie Allen's seat. These are two of traditionally regarded as the iconic type liberal Melbourne seats. And the response I got was very similar. Strong sense of resentment towards Scott Morrison, a sense that he wasn't one of us. No enthusiasm whatsoever for Anthony Albanese, in fact, but not much to say about Anthony Albanese. Perhaps reflecting a sense that he isn't very interesting, or this group wasn't particularly interested in him or particularly cared. And so this sort of anecdotal experience, anecdotal conversations I was having, I've been trying to work out how that fits into what we're seeing in the polls, okay, and what this data is telling us. The poll data is telling us that the coalition is particularly in trouble in the inner city, so-called teal seats, and particularly with women. The polls are indicating to us that what was Morrison's greatest political advantage or electoral advantage in 2019 is now working against him, which is a persona that he is a regular person of the Australian suburbs, the what Malcolm Turnbull calls the semi-confected daggy dad persona. And why I think this attribute has changed in terms of the effect it's having on voting is because some of the events of the last 3 years. On their own or in isolation, many of these events weren't particularly significant to the nation. And we're talking about Barnaby Joyce leaving his wife for one for his press secretary. We're talking about the allegations of a rape in a minister's office. We're talking about the Prime Minister's response that his wife told him, you know, imagine if something like that had happened to your daughter. And also the allegations against the Education Minister, Alan Tudge. And as I followed these events as they happened, I thought, well, they're all very interesting in an individual way, but I'm not sure that they're going to have, at the end of the day, a big effect on the election, and they may not. But the polling and Morrison's weak polling numbers with women suggests that they have. And I think, say, in the Barnaby Joyce example, which is quite important in the inner city seats, because Joyce's position as Deputy Prime Minister is one of the primary arguments used by the Teal Independents against Dave Sharma and Trent Zimmerman and Josh Frydenberg. And I think when Joyce left his wife, some women across middle Australia thought, well, that could happen to me. That is an example of a failure of moral behaviour, which in my personal life could have devastating implications for me and my family. And so you could argue that the morality of politicians is irrelevant to how they do their job, but I think it isn't. I think in an electoral sense, it has an impact. Then we go to Kooyong, where Treasurer Josh Frydenberg is going against a doctor, a female doctor who saved children's lives. She is a very strong opponent. And on the weekend, all everyone talked about was how many posters there are across the electorate. No one I spoke to had ever seen anything like it in their life. And it was a huge topic of conversation. The reported figures are that Frydenberg has spent $3 million in the seat, which is a figure I've never, ever heard spent on a single seat in an Australian election. And while you could argue that it comes a point where the posters don't matter anymore, what matters is the actions and the arguments. But what they have done is they have allowed his opponent, Monique Ryan, to have the standing of almost equivalence to the Treasurer. So someone who isn't even in Parliament, who has never been known before, because there are so much visible signs of her political campaign, she is, I think, in the minds of people in Kooyong, a valid contender. In the way you saw Zali Steggall in 2019, in part because she'd been such a successful Olympic athlete. So Liberals I speak to are seriously worried about losing Kooyong and North Sydney. Now, I have no idea if either will fall, but if Kooyong in particular falls, it will have huge ramifications for the Liberal Party because it will remove the prime centrist contender for leadership. It will open the door for the Conservatives to take over the party in a leadership sense, and for the Conservatives to enact what I think has been one of their long-term ambitions, which is to focus the Liberal Party not so much on the inner suburbs, but the outer suburbs, the regions, to go after the blue-collar vote, bring it across from the Labor Party. So I think it'd be real. So in that sense, this election is as much about the future of much a contest for control of the country as in one that may determine the whole future of the Liberal Party. It's a bit hard to judge. In fact, you know what? It's almost impossible to judge sitting here in our privileged inner city locations how Morrison is going down in the suburbs and the regional seats. I presume that there are regional differences. In Western Australia, for the Liberal Party, you just can't ignore the popularity of the Labor government and the isolationist approach it took to COVID. To pretend that there isn't a hangover on that, I think, would be denying reality. And so with only two Liberal seats, and I think two national seats in the West Australian Parliament, maybe three national seats, clearly there is a sort of reservoir of pro-Labor feeling in that state, which the Liberal Party and the Coalition has to run into. Queensland is also obviously heavily LNP in terms of the House of Representatives. And Liberals tell me that Dutton is concerned about losing Brisbane, which is on 5%, and Ryan, which is on 6%. In South Australia, Boothby's a Liberal seat on 1.4% in Adelaide. It would seem to me to share some of the characteristics of the teal seats in Sydney and Melbourne. It's mainly white, middle to upper class. It's sort of post-materialist in one sense, although in another sense it isn't, because at the last election, the dividend imputation issue, I think, helped Nicole Flint retain the seat. But it would strike me that if a teal candidate can do well in North Sydney, she can probably do well in Boothby too. I don't know what the mood is like in Bass, in Launceston. The margin there is very thin. It's less than 1%. But if the incumbent member, Bridget Archer's high-profile disagreements with Morrison have sort of penetrated the local consciousness, you'd have to imagine that maybe she's got a chance of holding on if there's a big national swing. In Victoria's incredibly interesting because Liberal Party hopes that the disenchantment with Daniel Andrews' management of the COVID pandemic could help them win seats. Maybe Corangamite, which is on 1%, Corangamite's down the Surf Coast, and McEwen, which I think is in the northern Melbourne suburbs, which is on 5%. Now, today, Daniel Andrews and Anthony Albanese stood up, I don't know if you've seen the news, and Albanese promised to put $2.2 billion into a suburban underground rail line going around Melbourne, which will go through Chisholm. Chisholm is held by 0.5% by Gladys Liu, who has struggled perhaps more than any other Liberal politician to find her voice or find her way of communicating. And she's in this acutely difficult position of having to straddle Chinese communities, some of whom will have sympathy for the Chinese Communist Party, I imagine, and a general national mood, which is obviously very hostile to the Chinese regime. And she has not been able to finesse that, which is quite understandable because she's a bit of a political neophyte. So Albanese and Andrew stood up today for this project. It's hatched in secrecy. It's unclear if Melbourne needs it. There are credible estimates that it will cost $100 billion. You could run buses on the outskirts. Andrew stood up and he just slammed Morrison. He said, what do you call it? The miserly Morrison government hasn't given us a cent. And this shows that when you want to work with people, when you want to get things done, you've got to work with them. Well, the Andrews government refuses to put the project to Infrastructure Australia for an assessment as to whether it should go ahead, whether it's absolutely necessary. At the same time, one of Albanese's biggest promises is to strengthen Infrastructure Australia. He says he created it, and this has to be a non-political national body which is going to ensure we don't waste billions in infrastructure spending. But he is allowing Andrews to completely circumnavigate the infrastructure process and saying to him, well, for political gain, here you go, here's $2 billion. And I think for that $2 billion, he got his press conference with Andrews today. I'm not convinced that Andrews is the huge drag on the vote in Victoria that the Liberal Party thinks it might be. I think that society is pretty traumatised and split. And I think after what they went through, one of the longest lockdowns in the world, they would hate to sort of think to themselves that it was the wrong course of action, because the consequences of that are just too painful, that all the sacrifices they went through were unnecessary. And so whether the Liberals can win back Corangamite or not, it's going to be absolutely fascinating. But it is really in part a test because of the limited differences between the two major parties. It's in part a test on how Victorians feel about the Victorian Labor government. Now, in New South Wales, the Liberals here are trying to hold Reid, which is in the inner west, which is on 3%, and win back Gilmore, which is on the south coast. Are you looking at your watch? Should I speed up? Gilmore's on 2.6%. So the fascinating element here in New South Wales is the Catherine Deaves effect. So Catherine is a bombshell from Manly Vale whose signature issue is sex conversions. And she has been, she's 2 weeks ago, she was the fourth most quoted politician in the country. She was only 1,000 stories behind Josh Frydenberg, which is absolutely incredible for a person who doesn't hold office and was unknown publicly before this election. Her old tweets, which are sort of just the normal conversation on social media of a person highly engaged in a particular issue, caused the government caused a lot of negative publicity for the government. She was put away from national media for about a week. Then, I guess it was yesterday, Sky News got a camera crew and they went up to her and interviewed her on the footpath. And they asked her about her views. And her views were interpreted as pulling back from an apology she had issued for her language, particularly in relation to sex changes. And so we had this interesting, and then Morrison was asked about it today. He was here in Sydney in Epping and Bennelong for a press conference. And instead of sort of avoiding the issue, he opened it up. And he started talking about sex changes in teenagers. And then a journalist said, well, they're not allowed in Australia. The Federal Health Department says they're not accessible to anyone under 18. And he kept on talking about them. He said, this is a very important issue. And we have people who are thinking about doing this have to think about the long-term consequences. Now, who could disagree with that? Who could disagree with that changing your sex is not probably the most profound decision any individual can ever make? And who would think that adolescents have the foresight to be able to make this decision? I would suggest probably most people would agree. So I had this interesting experience, and reading on the Sydney Morning Herald website, they were discussing the legality of sex changes. And they said that even though it's true you have to be 18 and above, you can, as a woman or as a teenage girl, have your breasts removed if you're 18 or younger, which the industry refers to as top surgery. So the very fact that we're talking about this, that I was reading about this, I think was the point. I think it was to inject it into the public debate. Because common sense and focus groups are telling the Liberal Party that any discussion of sex changes amongst teenagers upsets or agitates parents. And you saw when Albanese was asked about it, he did not want to talk about it. His answer was very short, okay? And so whenever you hear sex changes, kids, and the Labor Party, okay, your brain is doing probably a subconscious linkage. I think that's what the coalition strategists are hoping. And their risk for them is that in the teal seats, voters hear or read transphobia. So the challenge here for what Morrison's trying to do is to separate this issue about sex changes in adolescence with transphobic attitudes, which is what Deaves was smeared with. And I think the fact that Morrison was explicitly doing this today is a sign of concern, because this is a pretty forthright issue to inject, very sensitive issue to inject into the election. So I read that as being a sign of concern about where the coalition's at.
Just a minute.
Yeah. Okay, well, I better drop the second quarter of my speech.
Maybe the Liberals come back.
So the Erregulla polls has a difference of 8 points, which is equivalent to a 5.5% swing to the Labor Party, which would be an extra 17 seats for them. 5.5% would, in historical terms, seem to be pretty unlikely. And history shows us that the polls usually narrow closer to election day, and the polls can also be entirely wrong, as they were last time. I suspect Morrison's got a lot of support with Christians, particularly in immigrant communities such as the Indians, who could determine close races like that in Reid. The hardest thing for the coalition is the small size of their parliamentary majority, which is essentially one. They have a nominal 76 seats, so they may be only able to lose two seats and retain power. So Morrison has to keep it the loss to net two. 3.2% swing against him is six seats to the ALP. So if he can get the swing down to two or less, he might be able to hold on. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jared. Thanks so much for having me this evening, everyone. And thanks for that. That was very instructional. Appreciate that. Oh, it was. Say again.
Thanks for coming.
No, it's a pleasure. I made it, as Jared observed. I'm a recent resident of Sydney and still negotiating the sizable difference in geography between Perth and Sydney. So I guess I wanted to, I'll start by just flagging what I want to bring to the table tonight. Very different from Aaron's forensic approach. I day-to-day live in the real economy. I run a small business that's 20 years old. Quite rightly, Jared said, I write for The Australian once a fortnight, The West Australian once a fortnight. I do a little bit on the wireless, and I contribute to Sherry Markson's program and Chris Kenny's program on Sky. So that's sort of my day-to-day life running a company, and my colleague Emily Dyer there taking some photos for social, so I appreciate that. And I just wanted to perhaps remark on a few things. I took some notes as you were talking, Aaron, and by far this is definitely not a debate, but some observations where I think perhaps my views are different, but also based on a very different experience. Aaron's obviously a lot closer to the day-to-day mechanics of the political world than I am. But I guess my first comments I'd like to make are about the Premier of Western Australia, Mark McGowan, and whether or not he'll actually be a net positive or a net negative in the next 2 weeks. And the reason that I say that is, yes, the isolationist policy was undoubtedly wildly popular early in the pandemic. Today, in the last 24 hours, you had the major ambulance service in Western Australia asking Western Australians not to ring 000. They said, don't ring 000 because the hospitals can't cope. Ambulance ramping is at something like 6,000 hours. The former health minister of Western Australia, Roger Cook, when he was in opposition, called 3,000 hours of ramping a state emergency. So now it's at about 6,000 hours. There is a $5 billion budget surplus in Western Australia, and the health system is on its knees. Why is that relevant? Because timing is so important. I think that in another 2 weeks, the McGowan government, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that there's necessarily a swing against, but it's not the love fest that it was 12 to 18 months ago when Mr. McGowan did not open the border in February, on February the 5th, as he planned to, when he made that announcement on the 20th of January that he would not in fact open the border. You would have all seen the heads of Australia's largest employer, Wesfarmers, basically said, we can't do business here anymore, we're leaving, and they all took off to Melbourne. It was Wesfarmers, there were a couple of other companies that did the same. Seven West Media, who I write for, changed its backing of the government overnight, basically, and began to run a very negative campaign or negative narrative around the government. And there's a tremendous staff shortage. I mean, there's a skill shortage everywhere in Australia, but Western Australia, up until last week, you had to get police permission to arrive in Western Australia, and you couldn't arrive in Western Australia without a third vaccination. You couldn't go to a restaurant in Western Australia without showing your vaccination certificate. So, yes, Mr. McGowan has been popular. Is he still the knight in shining armour? I don't think he is. The fact that Scott Morrison was very, very overt in his, you know, drawing him into his campaign events in WA is quite telling. Swan in Perth will be an interesting one to watch, with my friend Christy McSweeney taking over, hopefully going to hold that seat. So there are a few interesting seats there. But my observation about the West is it's not necessarily, a whitewash for the Libs. I guess I also wanted to talk about the comment that you made about your experience of North Sydney and Melbourne. I think that's so interesting because all of us, by virtue of the fact that we're in this room and Aaron and I are working in media, Aaron more so than myself, I don't necessarily think that my world and with respect yours are the greatest litmus tests for where this election is going to fall. I don't have anything other than a gut instinct, the same that I had in 2019, where I said on air about a week before the election, I just don't think Australians want a socialist left agenda. I just don't think they do. I have no data to base that on. I have nothing empirical to base that on. But I don't think it's a case of what people want the most. I think it's what they want the least. And I think to touch again, while we're just fresh on Aaron's comments about Catherine Deves, again, so fascinating. I don't think... I don't know about how, I can't comment rather on how that issue was brought into the political narrative, whether it was deliberate. Everyone seems to think it was. I've got no evidence to contradict that view. But I just feel like, let me rephrase that. We know statistically that the further that the further to the woke left the Labor Party goes in terms of policy and positioning, the lower their primary vote. That's just a statistical fact. I think the highest, most recent high primary vote they had was with Rudd in 07. I think it was, strike me down if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that was it. And as the party, which was once known, as we all know, my parents' generation, the Labor Party stood for families in the suburbs like mine. They stood for, working families. I like to say what family isn't working, very few of them. But the Labor Party no longer stands for that. And I don't believe Australians are, with respect to the Labor Party, as stupid as they are being taken for. I just don't think that. I think that the polls right now, there is such a huge percentage of undecided voters, and I don't blame them. Because I am as disengaged in this process as I've been ever. It's my job to be engaged, and it's almost like taking my medicine this campaign around. I've not watched a single leader's debate. Shame on me, perhaps, but I don't personally don't think those leaders' debates offer anything insightful, anything instructive. I don't think that they change a single vote. That's my view. I could be wrong. Happy to be wrong. So in terms of... in terms of what I want to touch on briefly, and I would appreciate time notes too, thanks, Jared, because I can talk all night under wet cement.
7 minutes.
Wow, okay, 7 minutes it is. The things that I'm hearing in the real economy, and to give you guys context, I have a corporate affairs business which is 20 years old. I have my head office in Perth, 6 staff over there, and myself and Emily here in Sydney. Our Sydney office is 2 years old, and... clients are in a range of spaces from listed through to not-for-profit, and the consistent conversations we are having around the election are around the things that don't change, and in my view, the things that both major parties have lost sight of. Cost of living, doing business in Australia. Emily and I were in a meeting today where one of the things that was discussed was the prohibitive cost of doing business in Australia, the over-regulated environments of doing business in Australia. How can Australia be competitive, whether you're an SME or whether you're in a well-developed industry or you're listed or whatever? And my view is that both major parties, and I mean, the proof is in the independents to a point, but I'll come to that in a second. My view is that both major parties are suffering an existential crisis that's several years in the making, you could argue a decade or more in the making. They don't know who they are. Let me talk about the Liberal Party, my party, obviously. When I say my party, I'm not a member, but someone said to me today, your flag's pretty much pinned to the wall, and that's totally fine. I think the Liberal Party is skating close to missing the opportunity to engage with the next generation of voters. And I say that because I believe that you've got a generation, I use my niece and nephew, for example, they're in their early 20s, and they are interested in politics, they want to engage in politics, that they look at the Conservative parties and they don't see a reason to engage. And I think that is a dark horse for Conservatives the world over, but in Australia especially so. You've got... again, from my observation, a language which is, you know, sit down and do as you're told, young person, you don't know. We talk about housing affordability, and you can talk about my parents, for example. My mum was a stay-at-home mum. She got married to my dad in 1969 in Brisbane. She got told she had to quit her job, when she got married, to go and keep house, even though we weren't born there. That was just the socially accepted, you know, middle Australian approach. She was one of 4 children, the only girl. She didn't get to go to university because she was a girl. All of those sorts of things. And you can say to a young person today who looks at the cost of buying a house and it's frighteningly prohibitive, and say things like, well, when I was young, and it's frightening because I start to say things like that now. When I was a kid, I didn't have the internet, which is true because I'm that old. But conservatives, I don't believe, are offering a pathway to young people to give them a reason or an understanding of what conservative politics looks like. And the other thing that I firmly believe is that there's a cohort in the Liberal Party and in conservatism more broadly that doesn't accept that being conservative in 2022 doesn't look like it did 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And they say things like, oh, well, being a conservative doesn't change. Well, it does change, because if it didn't change, I wouldn't be allowed to have a job because I'm a woman. You know, like when I got married, I'm no longer married, but when I got married, I would have had to have quit my job if conservative values didn't change. They simply are applied in a different paradigm to a different set of values. And I believe that if the Liberal Party more broadly doesn't get its head out of its own behind and start reading the times, you know, all of this wisdom and all of this, we're so wise in our own eyes, but they're not wise enough to sense the change of the season. So that's one of my observations about the Liberal Party. As for the left, again, they have become a party that is representative of such a niche part of our community. There's nothing wrong with that necessarily, except they have abandoned their traditional, the people who traditionally, you know, looked to them as a party that represented their values. I mean, my father arrived in Australia on a boat when he was 10, and I should by all rights be a Labor voter. I'm not sure how I ended up being a Conservative voter, but I am. But my point is, I use my aunt, my dad's sister and her husband as a great example. Both retired academics, they're, you know, staunch Labor voters all their lives. And they say things like, I remember 2019, I remember my aunt saying to me, you know, I can't vote for this, you know, for Bill Shorten, because I don't try, you know, it was a particular view of what modern Labor had become. And you could argue that maybe they're adapting with the times. Perhaps they are. But when you have a party that used to represent everyday workers, who is more, well, it was the one line that Malcolm Turnbull had in Parliament that I applauded when he said something about Bill Shorten, like, you've had your legs under more millionaires' tables than, does anyone remember that one? Yeah, that kind of thing. So this dual existential crisis where neither party knows what it is anymore, enter stage left, the teal independents. There's a vacuum, right? There's a vacuum of leadership. There's a vacuum of meaningful policy. And I think I'm not really in the media anymore, but, you know, I am, but I'm not. But I think the media has a responsibility to test more than it's testing. I think the teal independents are allowed to flourish in the absence of anything else. And I don't think, would any of those candidates be running if not for the backing of Climate 200? I don't know that they would. Why has not anyone pressured Climate 200 to be more forthcoming with their disclosure around potential conflicts of interest? That was only a very recent question. I think The Australian talked about that. How am I going for time, Jared?
You've got 1 minute.
Oh, no, the pressure. It's quite big. So I guess my view is, if I had to wrap this up by... wrapping up by what do I think will happen on the 21st of May? Well, I'll probably do what I did in 2019, which is stay away from the telly until, like, it's a done deal, because I can't stand the stress. But my again, it's just my gut. If I look at what's on offer, it's not that people particularly look at Morrison and go, what a guy, what a leader. I think they look at the left and the way that the Greens and Labor are in bed with the left, and I think they go, I don't really want that. That's my view. I wanted to talk about women. Maybe someone can ask me a question about that. So thank you for listening. So thanks for your time.
Well, thanks to Aaron and thanks to Gemma. As we said, the topic was the 2022 election, different views, and we've had different views. I think it's fair to say that Aaron probably thinks that that the government's going to fall, probably, and Gemma probably thinks that the government's going to survive. So that's a good way to start. So we're coming to the question discussion. We're finished at the top of the hour. Gemma wanted to talk a bit more about women, but I want to get Aaron's view on this. So I just want to lead off with this question, going back to what Aaron Patrick said. So you put the view, which was interesting, that a lot of women in Australia are fed up with the coalition because the Deputy Prime Minister left his wife. But a lot of women in Australia are fed up with the Prime Minister because he's a boring old fart who hasn't left his wife. So where's that all fit in?
I don't quite understand the question, Jared. Unless it's more a disagreement with my analysis, which then would make perfect sense, particularly coming from you. So does it go?
He just can't win because
he can't.
Don't like Morrison for one reason, and they don't like Joyce for another reason. So you add them together, that's a pretty big move.
But are you disputing the cumulative effect, or you disagreeing that it exists?
Am I allowed to take part in this?
Yes.
Why don't you go first,
Jim?
Oh,
no, hang on.
Jared, get both people.
You've got to come up here.
Oh.
Yeah, and you stand there and be quiet for the moment.
Sure.
And you come up here and finish your point, okay?
Well, you've been told, Jim.
You sit
next to me, Jim.
She hasn't been here before. I should have told you.
It's very provincial over there.
I think one of the perhaps the most interesting thing about the Morrison government from a political perspective is that when has a government been more disliked or resented and done such a reasonable job managerially? So we're told that they didn't order enough vaccines. It's not true. We had plenty of AstraZeneca's vaccines, just no one trusted it. AstraZeneca vaccines were made in Melbourne. We're told that that Morrison was a bad man because he took his family to Hawaii when the bushfires. Now, sure, poor timing, he apologised, but it had no difference on the outcome. No one died because he was there for a week, and no extra houses were burnt down because he was there, and no one was homeless because of that. Bad politics, didn't show leadership. But the consequences, I would suggest, were de minimis. A woman may have been raped in Parliament House. If this is true, then this is appalling. Sadly, people are assaulted every day in every country. And just because of the location that it happened in, I struggle to see why it's the Prime Minister's responsibility. Now, I guess the counter argument is that he sets the tone for behaviour in Parliament House. He does, but he's a one man, and he's a man, not a god. So I think, and I write about this at depth in my book, that those situations, plus the Christian Porter and Alan Tudd situations, were exploited for political purposes, and very successfully and effectively. And I think they're part of the reason that Morrison has lost a lot of women.
I don't know where to start. So I'll start with, I just don't agree with any of that. No, I agree with, apart from up to the point where you said that's why Morrison's lost support of women. Every woman that I speak to who has decided that they don't like the Prime Minister, it's got nothing to do with any of that stuff. Weirdly, we think beyond relationships. Weirdly, we think about our businesses and our companies and our careers and, you know, how hard is it to organise something versus how hard is it to wrangle 15, you know, two-year-olds at a birthday party on the weekend. I personally have never had a discussion with a friend or a peer or a colleague or a client around the government's capability or competency that has referenced any of that stuff. Because we know that Morrison is not the lightning rod for generations of poor behaviour in Parliament House. And I just think it's interesting you should talk about women, because I'm writing about that for this weekend's West Australian, in terms of this view that, oh, well, women's issues need to be on the table. Well, what are women's issues? A woman who's a stay-at-home mum, a stay-at-home Muslim mum of three kids in Sydney's West, or a stay-at-home WASPI mum on Sydney's Lower North Shore versus a woman who's living in Hyden in West Australia's Wheatbelt, who's 45 minutes from her nearest hospital, and even then it's telehealth. Please tell me that we can do a woman's election on all of those three women and make it homogenous. It's a very, and I don't mean this to you, Aaron, but pink budgets, pink elections, it's bollocks. It's unnuanced, and I think it's deeply disrespectful to women. So that's my view.
Now, I've got a question here from one of our Zoom people. It goes to Aaron. So it's from Vicky Sanderson, who obviously reads you in the Fin Review. Now, in your forays into the minor party meetings, which you've been reporting on in the Fin Review, did you get a sense of the level of anger towards the government?
In the minor parties? The vote for the minor parties will be a really excellent test of disillusionment among natural Liberal voters with the Morrison government. And so and it'll go both ways, left and right, off the Liberal Party. So if you see One Nation picking up, doing better than the Nationals in Hunter, that'll be a sign. If you see UAP picking up some strong numbers in the Senate, Queensland, maybe even New South Wales, that'll be drift from the right of the Liberal Party. Similarly, the Teals, strongest apparently in Goldstein. And what if Goldstein falls? Goldstein's on the Bay Suburbs in Melbourne. Tim Wilson's a libertarian, low tax guy. You know, in Tim's mind, he helped them win 2019 because he ran the campaign on the dividend credits. You know, he was the driving force behind that. And so if Tim was to lose Goldstein and he's behind in the betting odds, that would be one of the greater ironies of this election. You could say it's voters putting other interests ahead of their financial interests, or they just dislike Morrison and they don't want to see him on the television every night.
I've got another question here from Dimitri Bernstein. He says, both of you concentrated mostly on the Liberal Party, not the Labor Party, not the Nationals, not the Greens. And what does that say about the election, that you focused on the government, not the opposition or anyone else?
I think that what it says to my mind is that the contest of ideas is not as great as it could be. And we're doing what the Labor Party has wanted us to do, which is to not focus on them and to not focus on Albanese. Because Albanese has gone so far, moved Labor policy so far, so close to the coalition, we're not talking about them, you know. And who would have thought, seriously, you know, Labor Party agreeing to nuclear submarines, what, within 6 hours? Seriously? This is the party of the anti-Iranian party? Can you remember the debates we had in this country when Hawke was Prime Minister? Just about the Three Mines policy, and this was uranium for civilian energy purposes, and now Australia is going to buy nuclear reactors in warships, and the Labor Party took 5 seconds to agree. How remarkable is that? And so, we're not talking about them because they don't want us to talk about them.
Jimmy, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I guess I'd only say is my focus on the government is it's because it's theirs to lose, I suppose, and by virtue of the fact that, I don't mean positionally, I mean by virtue of the fact that they are the incumbent, they are the ones who are saying, give us another go, we've done X, Y, Z, give us another go. I mean, I try my best not to talk about the Greens at any given time. I still can't believe anyone votes for them. They're such a ridiculous proposition, but that's, yeah, I think the government is the one that has to say, give us another go.
Yeah. Just stay there.
Thanks both. Going back to your point, Gemma, that you don't see Australia as swinging to the left overall for the next government. It's interesting, you talk about, Aaron, when has there ever been such a sort of pong about government for a government to win? I remember Paul Keating in 1993.
Mm.
And I remember going through that election, which was assumed that John Hewson would be the next Prime Minister, saying, do people want to wake up on Monday morning and find John Hewson as their Prime Minister? So really what my basic question is today, we keep talking about, to me, whether it's women and work and all that, as peripheral issues. They're individuals. We talk about emotions, we talk about mental health, we talk about all of that. But the fundamental thing is people think who they want to run the country. And okay, it was very close last time, it could well be very close. We're still, with a 5-point margin or an 8-point margin, we're still talking about individual seats.
Sure.
So, Gemma, why do you think that? Do people overall really, at the, in the, when they come to vote, they really are thinking, do I want X as my Prime Minister? And how much, like today, when Albanese came out and virtually said we'll go for a wage inflation spiral, how much do the big issues now count?
Okay, but we go with Gemma, then we hear from Aaron. Yes, Gemma.
Sorry, can you just condense the question? Why do I think that?
Well, you've got this feeling that the overall, you know, feeling about who runs the country is where we really are heading when we vote, not whether I get a better deal when I'm employing 7 or 8 employees, or whether, you know, I get a better ride to the ambulance. In other words, the big question is the overarching question when you put your vote in for most people who you really want to run the country.
I think ultimately, yes. Ultimately, yes. I remember very clearly in 2019 a feeling as a business owner, as an employer, a feeling of palpable dread at the thought of a shortened Labor government. I thought things like, it's going to cost me more to employ people. It's going to cost me more to do everything in business. Is it even worth keeping the business? What if I just, you know, it was that kind of thought process. And I suppose that all across Australia there'll be microcosms of that experience. But ultimately, yes. And as to why I think that, it is simply just an observation. I listen really well. I think one of the things I do well, I don't do a lot of things well, but I listen really, really well. And what I hear, people aren't talking about the things that we talk about on Twitter, and people aren't talking about the things that the media think we're talking about. That's my
point.
Look, I'm not making prediction, Anne. What I'm really doing is just saying this is the current state of play with all the available information we've got. And so it may not pan out that way. And the polls have been wrong, and the markets are wrong in the past. Just in this case, it's miracles happen once. I don't know if they happen twice in a row.
Okay, so if you go down to the back and then we're coming up here. Just come back, Gemma. Just stay around. Yes,
I'm hiding.
Thanks, guys. Very quick one. Would the post-materials voters, who we've been talking about a lot tonight, will they come to regret that decision?
I spoke to one of my colleagues about this exact issue last week, and it's such a fascinating question. His name's Jacob Grieber. Mm-hmm. And he said, look, what is happening in these teal seats is wealthy people are going to, at risk of, taking out the members of the Liberal Party MPs who will protect their wealth. These are people in Kooyong and Higgins and Wentworth who will stand up in the party room and defend dividend imputation and trusts and, you know, what is it, a 25% capital gains tax. These are people, you take them out and you remove some of the primary institutional architecture protecting wealth, a lot of inherited wealth. And so he's saying these people are going to regret what they're doing. And I think that's a really interesting argument because, you know, Matt Canavan and Peter Dutton, that's not their argument. That's not who they're going for, you know? They're not going to stand up and say, no, we'll fight to the death for family trusts.
Do you have any more to make a comment?
I agree with what Aaron's saying. I see a massive amount of buyer's regret
just
there.
Come up.
Sorry.
Sorry.
There was an article in The Australian today talking about the move of where voters stood from the 1960s to today, whereas in the 1960s, 60% plus of university graduates voted for the Liberal Party, equivalent proportion of trade unionists voted for the Labor Party. And are we seeing, in a sense, the coming to fruition of long-term trends of realignment between what used to be called classes, and, you know, which is a long-term trend beyond this particular election?
I'll just add up a gem and then we go to Aaron.
Sure. My gut feeling is yes. It's funny you should say that because as you were talking, I wrote in my notebook, the comment I think you made in your comments, Aaron, about they're not one of us. Like, that's, I think, what you're talking about. I don't think you can look at someone in a particular environment, in a particular suburb anymore and assume which way they're going to vote. So my short answer is based on nothing but more than gut. I agree with you.
Sorry, what's your name?
Jonathan.
I went out to Lindsay a couple of weeks ago in Western Sydney, which is held by the Liberal Party on less than 5%, and I wanted to get the feel out there, and I went to St Mary's train station, and that's a pretty run-in area, and I spoke to the station manager there, and he said, mate, this place has taken off. We've got rid of the methadone clinic. He said, and a house sold down the road for $1 million.
Wow.
And we're putting 3 levels on the top of our car park at the train station because Amazon has opened up a distribution centre down the road.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And all the new communities, new Australians are moving here and building families and getting jobs. And he said the word gentrification. Now, this is a station, I think, one stop from Mount Druitt, which 20 years ago was a byword for disadvantage in this city. Yeah. So if we're in the middle of a transformation, political transformation of Australian society, it's been driven by an economic transformation,
mm-hmm.
okay? And it's having different effects in different parts of the society. And this might be the one election when all those different factors come up and we see it flow through to the parliament. And if that's the case, it may not be, maybe business as usual, but if that is the case, you could see a profound change in politics forever.
Aaron, in your travels, have you had any indication of pre-polls and whether they are differing seat by seat? I noticed pre-poll opened yesterday, 300,000 in one day in New South Wales. So if we're going to go to 50% pre-poll as opposed to 40% at the last election, do the next 11 days really mean much? And do you think the campaigning will change? Welcome both your answers.
Well, that's a very technical question, Jacqueline, which is pushing my knowledge of politics. I'm sure it wasn't deliberately intended to embarrass me in front of this great audience. Look, I saw a fascinating comment by Kevin Bonham last week, who's a Tasmanian, is it septologist? Is that what they're called?
Sophologist.
And he said, he pointed out there's a real misconception in 2019, which is that Morrison turned it around in the last week, maybe in the last few days. And he said that was nonsense. Because the pre-polling showed that Liberal Party support was constant for the last 3 weeks of the election campaign. And so that would indicate that there isn't as much change throughout the course of the campaign as we all assume, because we watch it, and as viewers, we see it reaching a crescendo. And as journalists, we have a natural indication to write as a narrative, with the starting point getting to an end point. But essentially, the voters are trapped in the middle. There isn't really an ending for them. They've already decided. So if that's the case, the election's over. Already, today.
Last time the polls were way against the Liberals, if that's true, and they were still voting
for them. That's true.
Gemma?
I really don't have anything meaningful. I don't have anything meaningful to add to that one.
There's a question here.
Yeah.
Well, this is your employee, so you should take it.
It's for both of you. And it's a two-part question.
Talk to me.
As an American, one of the things I have noticed is almost like this importing of American politics into Australia. A good example is the trans issue. We were blowing up about trans people in women's sport over a Penn State swimmer.
Yes.
Do you think part of the disconnect in Australian politics is because we aren't even talking about Australian issues? That's the first question. And the second question is, do you think Australia is at risk of becoming more partisan and more divided in a way that the US has, more conservative on one side and more woke on the other side?
First question, I don't think that's importing an issue necessarily. I have a friend who's, I won't disclose the sport she's in because I've not sold her permission, but I have a friend who's an elite national level sports, she's an athlete, she's a professional athlete, and 16, 18 months ago we had a conversation about that issue, and her comment to me was, why bother turning up? I'm defeated before I get there. And that was when nobody in this country was really talking about it. We were looking at the UK and the US going, oh, that's a bit of a knotty problem to solve. We weren't talking about it here. So my view is it was always going to arrive here. It's like when McDonald's started in the States, McDonald's was always going to get here. That issue was always going to arrive. That's my first view. Second, that's a really good question. I look into my crystal ball and I would say, I hope not. But I think in an environment in which we are so starved for real leadership, that kind of polarization of views is a byproduct of being starved of leadership. So,
Aaron?
Well, after this election, maybe, conceivably, you could have a leader of the Liberal Party from the populist right and a you'll have a prime minister from the left wing of the Liberal, of the Labor Party. And so those two leaders could unleash the atavistic forces in their political parties, which, you know, which leads to some great culture wars, as opposed to reversal of the convergence that we've had in the interim.
Well, just as a final follow-up question on that, it's a difficult one to answer, but the Liberals, or the Coalition, wins, Morrison and Joyce stay there, but what if it loses? If the Labor Party wins Albanese's Prime Minister, but what if Labor loses? What are your thoughts on that?
If Labor loses, there will be a generation of enormously talented political leaders there who will be completely dispirited, and they will question the whole Labor, you know, project, because they've tried both. They've tried ambition and a bit of reform, and they've tried compliance. And so if that doesn't work for them, they will despair greatly, and they will struggle.
And if the Coalition loses?
If the Coalition loses, I think open warfare, huge recriminations, particularly over, say, the New South Wales pre-selection issue, anger from the left. You'll have Malcolm Turnbull in the background, you know, looking with glee at what had happened.
Rubbing his hands together and
having parties.
It will unleash great internal tensions.
And the leader would be?
I don't know. It depends what happens in Kooyong.
Gemma?
Let me start where Aaron left off. Agree, if the government loses, you may as well be in an operating theatre in full PPE. There'll be so much blood. As to who would take over, you know, people talk about Peter Dutton. I don't see that personally. I just don't see that. So it would be, again, depending on where the chips fell. If the government wins, they really need to get themselves sorted. They really need to stop shilly-shallying around with some of the garbage behaviour and policy and lack of discipline. So one thing that's really, I found extraordinary about conservative politics versus the left of politics, the left are so disciplined. I'm not saying the fruit of it's necessarily good, but they are so disciplined. We come out and white out each other and carry on like university students. It's embarrassing. As for the other side, if Labor loses, again, I'm going to steal Aaron's wise words there. I think that will be catastrophically, just demoralising for their cohort. If they win, God help Australia.
That's not exactly. Just ask, who would be the likely Labor leader in a Labor loss?
Oh, I have no idea. I don't think Miles is...
I think it'd be a fight between... if Labor loses, they'll probably go the right, won't they? Probably Jim Chalmers.
Jason Clare.
Jason Clare gives a good speech. You know, good-looking bloke.
Oh, really? I don't reckon. I don't rate him.
Ask the factions.
Tough judge.
I think he's a good-looking bloke, but
tough
there you go. What would I know? We said we'd have two views. We've certainly had two views, and across a range of issues. And we're very grateful to both Jimmy Tognetting and Aaron Patrick for giving us their views tonight. When your book on ego, Malcolm Turnbull, and the Liberal Party Civil War comes out, we'd love to have you back. Whatever the result is going to be, an interesting book, irrespective of who wins on the 21st of May. And we'll have discussions after the election as well. But for tonight, thanks to both of you, and well done.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Aaron.